With our guest this hour, Bev Harris, Black Box Voting. We'll take your calls with Bev as we continue chatting about these strange things that have been going on with elections and the election booths and these electronic boxes. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Bev Harris with us. We'll get to your calls as well this hour. Bev, I want to thank you again, too, for spending time with us over all these years. I mean, you've really provided us with some invaluable information.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and it's always, I always just think it's so great that you have been on this story for really almost 15 years.
Yeah.
And people just weren't taking it seriously too much in the beginning, and now, look, it's, you know, congressional hearings, it's all over the news. Gee, we were right a long time ago.
Well, you know, another thing we keep pushing, protecting our power grid from a solar flare or an EMP attack.
Right.
And I mark my word, people are going to come back and say, we heard this on Coast to Coast. We should have listened to that guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's really such a pleasure to be here for that reason, because it was very difficult for me to get any of the message out in the beginning, because it just was not a popular story.
What do you think, after the election, the Hillary campaign people were doing? Pulling their hairs out? What was going on there?
You know, they didn't seem at all interested. In fact, I know some people who were closer to the Democratic Party infrastructure than I am, who tried to get them interested in finding out at least a little more details about what happened in the election in a couple of the locations where it was maybe more questionable. And they were soundly rebuffed. They wanted nothing to do with that. And so just my opinion, and I try not to get political, but I think in this last election, we had two candidates that were both not exactly what a lot of America wanted, I think. And so it was kind of like you kind of went with whatever your gut was, because she just didn't seem terribly interested in the transparency aspect of anything.
No, and I think that hurt her.
And
Donald Trump really, I think, for a lot of Americans, touched a nerve, because I think what he got was the "I'm tired of voting for a politician" vote.
Exactly, and we have a guy who's not your conventional politician, so you know, watch what you ask for, I guess. But I think that she embodied all the things that people were a little uncomfortable with the traditional politician. You know, she had to poll everything to decide what she wanted to say, and you know, it was just, I wish there was a happy medium somewhere out there in the field.
Yeah, I do too. And I think 2020 is going to be a very interesting time period.
It really is. I think we're kind of in a state of flux on just so many different things right now that it's really hard to predict where we're going to be heading.
I'm going to predict.
Oh, good. I want to hear it.
That there will also be a couple strong Republican candidates who will try to run in the primaries against President Trump if he so elects to run again.
That would not surprise me if he so elects to run again. It's interesting watching the Democratic Party just not, they're just still tone deaf, you know, the DNC. They're just still not quite, you know, getting their thumb on the pulse of what they did wrong or what the country wants. And so they're not fundraising very effectively. They're way, way down, from what I understand, in their fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's hard to know, because expect the unexpected, I think. We just don't know what world events are going to do either in so many different ways. So, my little piece of that pie, I actually have two little pieces now. One is elections, and I've got a second piece that I'm developing expertise on, because I realized belatedly, well, we didn't seem to have a lot of enthusiasm among politicians to make our election system more transparent and trustworthy. So, that might mean that some people, some places, are using the capabilities it has of changing votes. Well, if that's the case, what is the point of doing that in elections like the Registrar of Deeds, which I found a corrupt election there, or the assessor, or these different, you know, there's all these different positions, and now and then there's a really weird election in one of them that just doesn't look right. And I started to well, I thought, well, there, what we're looking at there is corruption in some small local pockets and potentially big ones. And how does that even work? Why would anyone even want to corrupt the Registrar of Deeds position, for example? Well, I found out by pulling indictments from everywhere in the country where a Registrar of Deeds had been indicted.
Uh-huh.
And very similar charges. You know. So I'm writing a book about American-style corruption, which is very different than what we think of in foreign countries where there's a policeman standing on a corner demanding a bribe. It's not like that. It's not violence. It's not none of that. But we definitely have it. And I was very surprised to find that the FBI tracks the convictions that they do of public corruption cases. And now, if you put this in the context, there's 3,000 election jurisdictions, basically, in the United States. The FBI convicts 1,000 public officials every year on corruption. I was stunned. I thought, that's a lot of corruption.
That's huge.
Yeah, and most, you know, it's a bunch of different things that they do. But when you see that, in fact, I found multiple counties now where every single county commissioner and the sheriff and the mayor and the election official were all convicted. And I think those are useful from a problem-solving standpoint because it gets us past the idea that we have to trust the government. And I'm not saying every place is like this. I'm just saying if any place is like that, we shouldn't have to trust every place. We should be able to go in and check. That's the whole reason for it. So I was actually very surprised to be able to document it, and I've been very careful to use the actual indictments and convictions. And it's kind of the way it's done in a lot of communities, not all. And for certain positions, sheriff is a really troubled position.
It sure is.
You know, anything that's signing contracts, county commissioners, city council, and so forth, is a little bit at risk. And of course, I guess president of the United States probably has a little bit of a value to somebody.
You think so? Let's go to the phone. John in Grants Pass, Oregon, to get us started. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Bev.
Hey.
Would like to know, is it possible for hackers to create voters and add them to a state's voter registration list and then assign votes to them during an election to affect its outcome?
Interesting question. What do you think, Bev?
Yeah, it's not the simplest way to do it. A simpler way to do it is to use the voters that are in there that never vote because they have their voter history right there in the voter database, and it goes back like 10 years. So you can always just do a sort and pull, you know, it's usually 10 to 30% of all the names in the list.
Is it tedious to do that?
Pardon?
Is it tedious to do that?
Oh, no, it takes about 5 seconds. I've done it.
That's it?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's really quick. The whole point of a database is simply rows and columns. It's like, you know, every row is a person's name and every column is like, did they vote in this election? Did they vote in that election? What's their address and so forth? So you'd simply say, I want you to sort by have they voted in the last election, and it'll take all the people that didn't and stick them at the top, and then you just grab those names and off you go. But you could also create names and put them in there, but there would be leaving more fingerprints if you did that.
Interesting takes, though, on just what could happen with the finagling. And you could do that from any place, couldn't you? You could do from North Korea. Right?
Yeah, because, in fact, in this last election, they found that I believe it's up to now I may be mixing up two of them. 24 or 39 states had their, it was a lot, though, it was over a couple dozen, had their voter registration systems penetrated by outsiders. And then I went back, and it wasn't just the last election. It turns out that it also happened in 2012, and it happened earlier than that. So they are online. And they sort of have to be because they have this national law that says they have to have a statewide voter registration list, which is constantly updated, you know, by the counties and so forth every day. And the counties have to keep accessing it all the time. And so it is sitting right there online, and some of that stuff isn't even at all secure. And it's just quite a target.
First-time caller, Neela in Terrell, Texas. Welcome to the program. Hi, Neela.
Hi, George. Well, thank you so much. I just wanted to let you know how much I love your show and your opinions.
Well, thank you.
And I'm grateful to be heard. Just sort of had a quick question. He said it was okay. I wanted to mention that I think President Trump's doing a great job, but there's a really important issue that none of the candidates have really addressed, and that is that while folks are focused on statues, which I understand the relevance of that, the greater, more imminent threat, I think, is that for some reason the government doesn't want to spend $1.5 billion getting the electrical grids protected. And I mean, we could have a huge solar flare left.
Yep. You know, gotta get that done.
It could wipe out like a lot of people. They say up to 50% in the first 6 months. And so I'm wondering if, and your nice guest there, I appreciate being able to hear, just what kind of trending and political influences could possibly cause people to be redirected from a true threat to their environment to something that doesn't really represent a present issue. And, you know, of course, I watch Ancient Aliens, so there's a lot of speculation there, you know. But
I'm a little unclear on the
trending.
I almost had that. Let me see. What kind of trending could redirect people from one issue to another, maybe? Is that what you were saying?
Do you mean electronically, Neela?
Well, not electronically, but just in the sense of the social consciousness of deciding.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
this is a great question. And I actually have seen this happen in the field that I write about. We call it the cattle chute. Okay. Oh, they're all going to this issue. We don't like that very much. And they kind of create, there are groups that pop up. We call them AstroTurf groups. It's like they're funded by these shadowy things, and they pop up, and they have this massive public relations arm, and they sort of take a related issue that's not exactly the issue, and they have everybody charge down that cattle chute, and then there's no one left to go to the main one. This happened with voting, where they all, you know, we first started bringing up the problems with the machines, and they started focusing on getting everybody registered that can possibly be registered, and universal registration and all this, and people are being disenfranchised with registration. But that's an issue, that's fine, but that's not the issue we were talking about. And they would basically kind of cannibalize the activism community and steer them down a chute. Apparently that's a tactic that's used politically by... It's a known tactic.
All right, let's go east. Greg's with us, Dumont, New Jersey. Good morning, Greg. Go ahead.
Good morning, sir. Happy Wednesday. Beverly, if you want to write a book about political corruption and elections, spend a couple decades here in New Jersey.
Yes, New Jersey. I have a whole book on New Jersey, but any more. Yeah, it's amazing for only having, what, it's only got about 20 counties or 30. Yeah, it's.
Wasn't that where American Hustle was out that way?
Yeah.
Arab scam?
I have a great quote from a New Jersey politician, and he said basically a lot of the business they do happens at these, they have these like Association of County, Association of Commissioners, these different meetings that are held, and they go there in persons, and he said they basically, you know, make sure they go there and they assume everything they say is being wiretapped because they're Jersey politicians.
Amazing. Let's go back to Greg, see if he had a question. Go ahead, Greg.
Well, George, the thing is, I was involved in a Democratic county, not where I live now, but years ago. Yes, a concerned citizen, that type of thing. And we went to our county chairman with a couple of guys who really know computers, MIT, Cornell, Columbia, and we said, these D-ball machines, you know, my 8-year-old nephew could hack this thing and change the numbers. And our county chairman, a good guy, said, well, you know what? Diebold gave us $50,000 as a campaign contribution. We're not going to go back on this now. And we just were incredulous. That's the reason. Today, I got at work, something I work in Manhattan, to show how bad the hacking world is. Maybe Beverly can comment on this. I got two giant envelopes of folders of stuff that I normally get every couple weeks in email. They were basically documents that showed some people's social security numbers as part of the information. And this giant company right here in New York, I can't name them, is afraid now because of the Sony hack a couple of months ago of sending anything that has people's IDs on it, social security numbers. That's how petrified the world is right now being hacked. I couldn't believe it.
Why do you have a file with their social?
It has to do with payroll.
Okay, so it has that.
They would only send this in paper form. They wouldn't send it in via email like we've been getting for years. And this was really chilling today, Beverly. I mean, this is the world that we live in. Remember, George, a guy named Yosef Asarius Yugoslavy from the last century from a place called Georgia?
Yep.
Said, I don't really care who votes. I care who counts the votes.
That's right.
What's his name? Mr. Stalin.
He had it down to a science. Okay. We take your text and your tweets as well. Tom, what do you have for Bev?
We have one from Patrice in Delaware. Please ask Ms. Harris what voting system she would put in place that she would have no problem with.
All right. What would you do, Bev, if you were running a national election center?
Sure. I would put in voting machines that take pictures of every ballot, which they do. But I would add some rules with that they must release the pictures of every ballot immediately on the web on election night, because it's just a computer file, right? And that they have to make sure that the public has the right to inspect both the pictures of the ballots and the actual ballots, and that they make sure the pictures of the ballots are yoked to the actual one with a number. So, in other words, there are places that say, sure, you can look at them all, but there's no way to connect the two, so you have no idea how to match them up.
Huh.
But that's actually a very simple, very doable, very inexpensive method, and there's multiple vendors who are producing that now, and surprisingly the resistance is coming from election officials who it could be they just don't want to be embarrassed, you know, because
it's their little fiefdom and they don't want to give that up, do they?
Yeah, I mean, nobody comes out in the morning and says, make me accountable. I want to be really accountable. You know, it's always kind of an uncomfortable feeling, but we have to just increase the accountability. And the great thing is the technology is there to do it now in ways that are really, really meaningful. We just got to do it.
Yeah. The is it expensive?
No, and the thing is they have to replace all their machines anyway, because the machines that they have now were built in like the 1980s and they don't even make the parts anymore. So they have to, and all the new machines have this capability. But what they are doing, and when I said they're resisting it, is the election officials are turning off the capability to audit it. It's a menu item. You can turn it on or off, and they're choosing to turn it off. Well, so then that's why I say it has to be not just the machinery, but a rule that says you have to not turn it off.
Well, in the pre-computer era, how long did it take to have a presidential election counted? Did they have it the next morning, or did it take longer?
You know, I can remember watching them, you know, put it up on the board, you know, on TV. And here's why. They had it parsed into small segments and hand-counted. Some of it was lever machine counted, but most of it was hand-counted. But they had it in small units. There have been, for example, in New York, I think it's still the rule, you can't have a ward or a precinct over 900 voters. If you stage the event correctly and get enough people out there participating as poll workers, you know, it doesn't take that long to count 900.
No, it doesn't. Bev, we're going to come back and take final calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Bev Harris with us, Black Box Voting. We'll get to your calls as well. Bev, how did you get interested in this, and how long ago?
Well, in the 90s, I've been a writer for decades, and I got interested in the 90s in complex financial fraud, the derivatives. I wrote articles when the derivatives were coming out for mortgages. I kind of like complicated things and making them more understandable for people.
You were writing about derivatives before most people even knew what they were.
Like back in 95, 96, back in there. It was in the 90s, I know. And I also wrote about embezzlement. I was actually commissioned by a corporation to figure out their own embezzlement, you know, and I talked to the embezzler and so forth, and I got my head around how fraudulent transactions work, and also transactions that are high risk. And so when I started learning about voting machines, actually, with, of course, we all got a little interested in the election process in 2000, in Bush v. Gore, but in about 2002, I started seeing that the same kinds of the same lack of accountability that had been kind of a hallmark of systems prone to embezzlement or high-risk systems was entering our voting system with these new electronic voting systems.
Uh-huh.
And so I started asking the same questions I would ask if I was looking into, how easy is this to embezzle from? How high-risk is it? And the answers I got were just appalling.
And I bet you got a lot of fodder for what you wrote about, did you?
Well, yeah, very quickly. You know, it's like every rock I overturned, there was something crawling underneath it. And so I wrote a book, and that book has been downloaded about 1 million times now. It was ordered by the White House, White House Library, back in 2004. Reportedly, it was found on Osama bin Laden's bookshelf. I find
wow.
that just bizarre and strange. But it was in good company. It had, like, Noam Chomsky and Greg Palast and a bunch of other good... So,
he was well-read.
It got a lot of traction. It was a downloadable version. I was like, how did he even get it in a cave? You know? But apparently someone downloaded it for him. But so right away I knew I was onto a topic that hadn't really been looked at the way it needed to be, and it got a lot of attention in 2004. And then what happened is in 2008 when Obama was elected, a lot of the people who were interested in the topic were interested in it because they didn't like George Bush, it turned out. And when they got Obama, they lost interest in the topic, which really
and it just went away.
Yeah, they're just like, well, okay, well, we got our guy in, so it's okay. But I and a few others just kept persisting, saying, no, it's not going away because we still don't know what the heck is going on with our vote count. And but over the years, you know, we started to come up with some solutions, and some of the vendors started to see the writing on the wall, and they made systems that could do those solutions. And so now we're at the stage of overcoming resistance to accountability. And, you know, sometimes that's because of corruption, and sometimes it's just because people don't want to be held accountable. But I think we'll get there.
Is there a state in the country that you think is doing a marvelous job with its elections?
I wouldn't say statewide. It's still county by county now because a lot of counties can do a lot of choosing of their own. Humboldt County, California is awesome. It looks like Dane County, Wisconsin is coming along. The state of Wisconsin and the state of Michigan both have the right kinds of laws in place, which allow the public to see both the ballot images and the ballots. But I tell you, the resistant states are shocking. I mean, the fellow in Arizona, when he found out that the election officials were immediately destroying the evidence, he went to court, and the judge ruled in his favor and issued an injunction and said, you can no longer do this. Then the legislature tried to go in and pass a law that says no one can look at this stuff. I mean, it just boggles the mind when the stuff is right there to prove the results, and there's nothing wrong with looking at it. And they just say no one can look at it because all elections must be final.
Let's go to the phones. West of the Rockies, Port Angeles, Washington. Tom's with us. Hey, Tom, go ahead.
Hello, George.
Hi, Tommy.
Bev Harris, the peninsula's only legitimate political celebrity. How are you?
Hello there. Yes, I am from the peninsula. Although I actually went down to see the eclipse. I was in Lincoln City yesterday.
Perfect.
I got to do it, too. I'll meet you someday, somehow. I don't know where. Yeah. Anyway, I'm happy with the chain of custody, how that's supposed to work here in Washington State. I like the paper ballots. I've got some questions about availability of your viewership. But one of the most important things, there's two things that are really important, is checking on the validity of the voter the voter registration, and then stopping it at some time just prior to the election, making sure that everybody is a legitimate voter. And then number two, back east, all those little tiny counties over there, you know, you see the map and they're all small. That's because that was about how far you could get on a horse in a day.
You're right.
Like,
yeah,
right. If we could consolidate a bunch of those counties so that they have bigger counties, that would That would be a big plus in getting it all to work right. What do you think?
Well, I think I agree with you on some things and not on others. For example, they've got to cut off the voter registration before the election and have a firm list. The trend is that they have this constantly changing list, which continues to change all the way through election day, and then when you try to account for anything, they say, well, at what point of time, you know, we can't because it constantly changes. That's ridiculous. You know, you have to be able to compare a known set against some other known set. How many people voted? Are there that many people on the list? You can't keep changing it right in the middle of the election. You know, in New England, they have not county elections, but municipality. And for example, New Hampshire has 235 little jurisdictions, and it really helps. So I don't know about making things bigger. Keeping them small can really help, because for one thing, it's a lot harder to hack it or manipulate it, because you have to get at like 235 different places, and also because they each have a more manageable set of data to deal with. And so I found that I kind of like the small township approach. The other thing about the chain of custody in Washington State.
And what does that mean?
That means, okay, everything in Washington State is a mail-in ballot. A chain of custody problem is when it leaves public view at a point in time. So if you envision the comparison, I've got a polling place. A real person comes in. I see the real person. I'm an observer. He then goes and puts a ballot in a box. I see that and signs his name in the poll book. You know at all, and then you count the ballot right there. You know the chain of custody.
Right.
If a ballot gets filled out by someone, we don't know if it's a ballot printing company or if it's a voter, and then it gets dumped in a box, a drop-off box, or put in the mail, we don't really know whether the ballots that get counted are all the ballots. Are they the extra ballots? Are they replacement ballots? So there's a problem with vote by mail with chain of custody. The other issue
is the entire state is vote by mail?
Washington and Oregon are both all vote by mail now.
You don't go to an election place or anything like that?
No, no.
Wow.
And
was that to save money?
Pardon?
Was that to save money?
It doesn't save money. It costs more, actually.
Does it? Okay.
It is simpler for the election administrators to administer. But the other issue, I've really been researching to go, if I wanted to rig a vote by mail system, how would I do it? And I'll tell you, the whole thing is based on signature comparison. You sign the outside of the envelope, not the ballot, but the outside of the envelope, and you have your signature in the database, and they have an electronic system. They tell you it's a real person. It's mostly an electronic system, which does the signature compare, kind of like a bank does, right? You can set the tolerance, and you can say accept like a lot, be really loose in your tolerance, or you can set it to be really tight. And you can even have it set differently for different classes of voters. And that's where I just got a phone call today from a voter in King County that had a really suspicious situation where her, you know, her signature is always accepted, and suddenly it kicked out her signature, and it was in a very tight election, and she had donated to the other candidate, and she went and asked him for her signature, and, it should have matched and so forth. But I think that signature comparison phase, it's actually all automatic, and it's very prone to large-scale fraud.
Okay, let's go to Joe, Long Island, New York. Hi, Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, Bev, happy day after the eclipse. I want to ask you about the gamers. Those guys seem to be expert in the computer, and I wonder if there's overlap with the hacking crowd. And can a smartphone hack, say, somebody waiting for a roller coaster or waiting for the ski wolf, hack, if the roller coaster is put on the web, hack the roller coaster with a smartphone?
Well, can you, I don't know about roller coasters, but some of what was done at DEF CON recently was hacking the voting machines with smartphones.
And they demonstrated that, didn't they?
Yeah. I mean, essentially, a smartphone is just a connection to the internet that has a few different parameters to it. And, smartphones, like computers, can be taken over by someone else as well and spoofed and so forth. I don't know if I answered your question well, though.
Yeah, well, also, like, you know, what is the expert crowd? Who are the top experts in hacking, and where could they be in the world?
Oh, well, you know, it depends what you're hacking, but there are, with voting systems, there are a few that I think are pretty good. One's named Harry Hursti, and we brought him in the movie Hacking Democracy. He's from Finland originally, but he lives here now. Another guy named Alex Halderman, I believe, from University of Michigan. However, a lot of the people who say they're experts are actually academics who don't have real, you know, an actual expert in hacking really needs to be able to understand that black hat hacker. And he needs to be able to think like a criminal. He can't just be in an ivory tower thinking up possibilities.
That's right.
Some of the academics are way off. Like, they told the press, I can't even tell you how many major newspapers, CNN, said before the 2000 election that it could not be hacked because it's not connected to the Internet. That's because they got that from academic so-called experts who were dead wrong. The stuff is connected to the Internet, period. And the voting machines out in the precincts are, but then they bring them all into one central location, connect it up, and the main vote count is right there online. So, you know, it's frustrating because the European community has this Chaos Computer Club and Anonymous, and they're all kind of scary guys, but they were able to get this stuff banned in a lot of European countries because they just walked in and demonstrated it and said, look, I can have my way with this thing. It's a very friendly guy.
First-time caller, Mark in St. Louis. Hey, Mark, go ahead.
Enjoyed the eclipse here.
It was something, wasn't it?
Amazing.
Oh, just amazing.
It sure was.
For years and years, I have been telling people, in my opinion, a relatively large percent of people who are registered to vote are illegally registered to vote. And everybody poo-poos it and says, no, it's 2%, it's whatever, it's down in the noise. And, I mean, like, when my children went away to college, they registered in a different state, and they were still registered back here. And I know, I've heard stories of people who are registered in multiple states, vote absentee, fake names. You know, what you talked about, dead people.
Mm-hmm.
I understand prisoners, felons are not supposed to vote, but and then illegal immigrants, once they're issued a driver's license, they can register a vote.
Well, there's some caveats, like, but so this is more complicated, like so many things are, which makes it automatically boring in some ways, but. For example, a person getting a driver's license, they don't get automatically registered to vote. They have to check a box and sign their name that they're a citizen. However, I know that they often do get registered, not even from their own malicious intent, because the person doesn't explain to them and they don't read the fine print and they say, here, why don't you just check this box? And they just kind of do. I'm not sure that names on the list that aren't really legitimate names on the list are actually going and voting very often, but they represent, as I mentioned before, a slush fund, so that the technicians who use these things, they can find those names pretty quickly and just cast votes in their name if they want to.
Is it tough to detect fraud, Bev?
If you have the right safeguards in place, no. However, we've almost been systematically disabling the safeguards one after the next. So we, like the caller from Port Angeles said, we never stop registering people, and we don't ever have a fixed cutoff point. So what are you even comparing to? I mean, you can't do that. It's like saying I'm going to look at my bank statement, but my bank statement is going to continue to change the whole time I'm trying to reconcile it.
Right.
You can't do that. You have to. It's just common sense. You have to have a fixed cutoff point so you're comparing one known thing against another. And you have to be able to let the public see, and you have to have a paper ballot. They're going with all these shiny new things, not just absentee voting, but another big trend is they're calling it the combined vote center. So instead of going to your neighborhood polling place, you go any place and vote, and it will magically find you, and that's got a whole other set of wrinkles and lack of checks and balances. So it's just so frustrating because they go with what is popular, but they don't think through, because they make an assumption that we are never dishonest in this country. Basically, that's what it is.
That's not a good assumption.
Well, it's kind of a ridiculous assumption, but you are it's really taboo to talk about that someone might actually change the outcome of an election maliciously, and you're not just supposed to talk about that. But the truth is, there's lots of convictions. I mean, some of them are just amazing. As I say, as I look through corruption, I come across election officials who tampered with the election and got convicted of it. So clearly it exists. So our position that it doesn't happen so we don't have to have safeguards has got to be changed.
When they tamper, is it for an individual that they want in there as opposed to an issue or some kind of ballot issue?
Oh, both. You know, ballot issues in Arizona, this gentleman, John Brakey, who got involved, he first got interested because of a transportation bond. In fact, these bond issues where they want to, pass a bond and get a bunch of money, there's a lot of money behind those because the guy who issues the bond gets a percent and all this other thing. And the people who get to do the construction for the bond get a bunch of money. So there's the issues, and then there's also the specific people and positions. You may want to get a particular commissioner in because he's going to vote for a certain waste management project, and the guy that's got the guy there has the cash. So there's a lot of different reasons you may want to get somebody in, and typically, any ballot question is actually sort of at risk if it's contested.
Well, it sure is. Bev, we are out of time, but let's keep in touch. Let us know when the new book comes out. Bev Harris, Black Box Voting, up next. Ancient Ancestors, here we go.